case numbers 2039 and 204044, Benton Benalcazar et al. Versus Genoa Township, Ohio et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Guzzo, you may proceed for the plaintiffs.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please the court, Peggy Guzzo, counsel on behalf of intervenors appellants. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you. Intervenors appellants are here on appeal from the Ohio Southern District Court from its opinion order entered on August 24, 2020. The district court granted in part and denied the rest intervenors appellants motion to dismiss plaintiffs appellees complaint entirely. And it also accepted the consent decree entered into by defendants appellees and plaintiffs appellees, which intervenors are not part of. The matter arises from the plaintiff appellees, the Benalcazar's complaint claiming that the results of the Genoa Township referendum in 2018 denied their substantive due process when it denied their rezoning from rural residential RR to PRD, planned residential district. Secondly, they claimed that the referendum violated—
Ms. Guzzo, can I ask you a question that really is for all three of you, and just help orient me in the case. One thing that seems a little odd to me about the case is this assumption everyone seemed to share that a ruling on the 12B6 motion was central to whether you could have a consent decree. And I guess I'm just not sure I understand that. You know, the point of a settlement is to resolve differences. And the only reason a federal court couldn't participate would be because there was no subject matter jurisdiction. But a 12B6 motion doesn't go to subject matter jurisdiction. That's a merits point. So what I find myself, frankly, quite confused by was the fact that you were allowed to intervene just for 12B6, not for the consent decree, but everyone thought the 12B6 was central to the consent decree. I find myself thinking the 12B6 motion's irrelevant. If the parties want to settle, they can settle. I mean, the only reason they couldn't is if there truly was not subject matter jurisdiction, i.e. no federal question at all, or one that's so frivolous it didn't implicate the subject matter jurisdiction of the federal courts. Can you help me through that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that is our contention, is that the reason that we intervene is that we believe it's a sham process, that there's no real controversy. They filed a complaint because, in essence, they didn't like the results of a referendum. They didn't have a substantive due process claim. They didn't have an unequal protection claim. But yet they sought in the federal court relief claiming that they had a claim in order to implicate a 505.07 within the revised code, Ohio revised code.
But just to be clear, under Steel Co. and Hood, to be a sham, your word, the claim has to be so frivolous that it doesn't even implicate the subject matter jurisdiction of the federal courts. That's a very different standard from plausibility under 12B6. And I fear if that's your position, you have a very steep climb. It's not that hard to file a non-frivolous complaint.
I believe that they don't have a plausible claim, and because—
No. Plausible's 12B6, all right? That's exactly the point I'm trying to make. Frivolous is what you need to show that there's no— Judge Marbley had no authority over this case.
Well, I would contend that our position, and I think our argument lays out, that not only is there not a plausible claim, but let me finish, but it's also that it was a frivolous lawsuit, because there was no claim. They could not even make an argument that there was. The other thing is that, as the Supreme Court has pointed out, as well as the Sixth Circuit, when you're entering a consent decree that is actually going to infringe on somebody else's fundamental 14th Amendment rights, that you have to take pause and actually look to see if there's an actual controversy before agreeing to that. And in this particular case, this neighbors, the interveners, are neighbors to this subject property.
Why, if that's true, didn't you appeal Judge Marbley's decision not to allow you to challenge the consent decree? That seems to be the way to channel that concern.
No, we actually did appeal. But what we did is we asked to intervene, and the basis of our intervention was to challenge that there was no real controversy. And because there's no real controversy, the federal court, the district court, had no subject matter jurisdiction to enter into a consent decree.
I hear you. I hear you. I just want to make sure we're not talking past each other. You know, people make alternative arguments. Judge Marbley, under Rule 24A, said you could intervene solely to deal with the 12B6 motion, not to deal with the consent decree. And I'm making the point, to the extent the federal court had subject matter jurisdiction, the way for you to serve your client's interests would be to claim that the consent decree doesn't account for the 75% of Genoa Township voters who oppose this development. But your appeal does not say Judge Marbley erred in refusing to let you challenge the consent decree.
Well, no, what we did say is that we are appealing the whole thing. What we said was, when we filed our motion to intervene, we had to file a proposed answer. GTRD Inc. filed a proposed motion to dismiss under failure to state a claim. Luke and Janine Schroeder's budding property owners, who are also part of GTRD, filed a separate motion to intervene, and they filed a proposed answer. Judge Marbley came back and said, okay, you guys qualify under 24A and as well as 24B, you can intervene, and you can, for the sole purpose of challenging the sufficiency of the complaint. Now, it didn't say just to 12B6. It said the sufficiency of the complaint. So we took that to mean that the proposed answer that we had filed for motion to dismiss, which we said 12B6 and subject matter jurisdiction, it wasn't just to 12B6. We added that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction because there's no real controversy, no real federal issue. And so that's what we did. We filed that, what we proposed, and jointly they filed that. So I don't think that the district court's opinion limited us to just a 12B6. It allowed us to follow our motion, which challenged their complaint, whether or not there was a real complaint, and whether or not the district court had subject matter jurisdiction because it lacked a real complaint.
So in your appellate brief before us, do you say the district court made the mistake of thinking of this as a 12B6 case? He should have thought of it as a 12B1 case. And you, the Sixth Circuit, need to consider this as a 12B1 case, say there was no jurisdiction to handle the complaint and therefore no jurisdiction for the consent decree. Is that in your appellate brief?
What is in our brief is we...
Be kind to us. Is that in your appellate brief?
It is, but it's under different, the way that you're assuming that, or that not assuming, you stated that the district court just only ruled on the 12B6. The district court actually ruled on our motion that was attacking the complaint for lack of controversy, as well as our complaint for subject matter jurisdiction. So it ruled on both, and we appealed both its decision. May I proceed?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, silence is a good sign.
Thank you. Okay. So again, so the matter arises from the complaint stating the plaintiffs have stated that their substantive due process was denied because they were entitled to a PRD zoning, that they were denied equal protection of the law because of the results of the referendum. And they based that on that the results of the referendum was not rational, or that they were targeted out of ill will.
What about the animus evidence, the phrase Mr. Benghazi which is in the complaint. And then there's actually someone quite explicit on this front at the consent decree hearing, using the word terrorist, if I'm remembering. Now that's of course after the complaint, but it's consistent with the allegation, the complaint. What do we make of that? Doesn't that sound like a class of one animus?
You know, it doesn't, Your Honor. The name, even the deputy, when he was saying the name, Ben Alcalzer, it took me a long time to say that name. I think there's an elderly gentleman there that doesn't hear very well, that he tried to pronounce it. And that was a name that probably was in news many, many times.
Are you saying the word terrorist was also a pronunciation problem?
I don't think they said terrorist.
I think at the consent decree hearing, someone says that.
I don't recall anyone saying the terrorist, certainly not.
All right. Well, we'll see. So you're saying in the complaint that that's not enough for an animus, a non-frivolous animus-based complaint?
Absolutely not. I think that to set aside the results of a referendum based on a couple people, maybe one person not being able to pronounce a name that's very hard to pronounce, it doesn't rise to the level of animus. Just as Central Powell Crossing, the District Court of Ohio, Judge Graham found that when they tried to state that there's an unequal protection because there's some animus, because three petitioners said some things that were maybe unkind or whatever against the developer, but that wasn't enough to impute the whole vote of the referendum of the citizens.
What is the standard to set aside a referendum in Ohio?
It's got to be compelling evidence that there is some sort of like fraud or something like that, or that it does.
To enter in a consent decree, they have to establish there was some fraud in the referendum, or?
Oh, no, I misunderstood your question. I thought you were asking in a general sense. So the second part, what I was going to say, as far as the constitutionality of it, the Ohio Supreme Court said that it has to be beyond reasonable doubt. That's what they equated to, beyond fair debate, that the results of the referendum was not based on some rational.
Okay, Ohio allows the referendum, but Ohio also allows a consent judgment in these circumstances. And what do you say is the standard they have to meet to enter into a consent judgment that in effect nullifies the referendum?
I think that's a really good question. In fact, the provision is 505.07. It's very rarely used since its inception, just a handful of cases, none in this particular situation. But basically what you have to have, and it's a useful tool, if there's a real controversy, then you have to have that option.
Okay, you have to have a controversy. You don't need to have fraud. You don't need to have irrationality, all these other things you talked about. If there is subject matter jurisdiction, the parties in this circumstance can settle the case despite the referendum. Is that correct?
Right. If there's a real controversy in each of the cases.
All right. All right. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Guzzo, you'll get your full rebuttal. Who is next?
Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph R. Miller, Rory Sater, Seymour and Pease on behalf of appellees Catherine and Benton Benalcazar, who are here with me today. I've noted that I would cede 3 minutes or whatever my remaining time is to counsel for Genoa Township as well.
Do you mind at the outset just helping us with the orientation? You probably heard my question. I found myself thinking the briefs are really looking at 12b-6, and if you want to use a rule, it would be 12b-1, but the case law would be Steel Co. and this Hood decision that says, as long as you've got a non-frivolous complaint, there is subject matter jurisdiction. If there's subject matter jurisdiction, you can usually settle the case without more pleadings, more decisions, or appeals.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I apologize that in the briefing, that really did get conflated, the idea of whether we've stated a claim or there was subject matter jurisdiction. In fact, there is unquestionably subject matter jurisdiction when the Federal Declaratory Judgment Act is invoked, when 42 USC Section 1983 is at issue. I completely agree
with
that.
So do we even need to rule on Judge Marbley's 12B6 ruling? I feel like all we need to do is say these were not frivolous allegations, and
you do not need to reach the merits.
Just one other follow-up question. Just sure. I want to be fair to Ms. Guzzo. I mean, because I think you have to admit this is an unusual situation, and if it weren't for the fact that the Ohio statute actually allows for settlements and consent decrees, I would not be your friend in this case, because this really looks sketchy from the voter's perspective. But it does seem fair for them to be able to challenge the consent decree from the perspective. I mean, I know Judge Marbley said you're here just for 12B6, but I don't know how you can slice it that way. It seems to me if they can challenge 12B6, they can make arguments that the consent decree is not respecting their interests. I mean, there's still obviously quite a bit of deference on that, but it seems unusual to me that we would not be able to say the consent decree fairly handles this dispute.
It does handle this dispute. And in fact, under the law of this circuit and the United States Supreme Court, you actually cannot reach the merits of Judge Marbley's decision on the 12B6. Under the Scott Ladd decision of this circuit, quoting Scott and Company, I believe, out of the United States Supreme Court, it has been held that you may not consider the merits of the cause. And instead, this is the quote, a decree which appears by the record to have been rendered by consent is always affirmed without considering the merits of the cause. And so I appreciate the court reorienting us to that issue, because I think we got lost in the unique posture of intervention by Judge Marbley, where he said, okay, they can intervene solely for purposes of a motion 12B6. And I agree with you, that has not been appealed. In other words, appellants have not sought from this court the right to contest the consent decree. And so the inquiry under the law of the circuit ends there. Even if you wanted to go beyond that, Your Honor.
Well, just to be fair to them, they might have thought, given the way the intervention motion was handled, that that was off limits. And of course, the whole point of doing the 12B6 was to prevent this consent decree. So it does seem to me embedded in their appearance in the case is authority to say, we think this consent decree is unfair.
Well, regardless, then they have, first they have the hurdle that they can't surmount, that they can appeal the consent decree. There's only four instances in which it's allowed, and none of those exist here because there is subject matter jurisdiction and no fundamental right of the appellants has been infringed by the consent decree. Instead, they complain about the availability of 505.07. So since the circumstances for appeal of a consent decree don't exist, your inquiry can end there. But even if you are inclined to give interveners the benefit of the doubt, they still need to have standing to contest the consent decree. They do not. They don't meet any of the three requirements for standing. And in any event, even though they didn't appeal whether the settlement is fair and reasonable, the settlement is unquestionably fair and reasonable. There is There is no evidence to the contrary. And any suggestion, Your Honors, that this was a sham lawsuit, I don't file sham lawsuits. My law firm doesn't get involved in straw man settlements. This was contested litigation on valid claims that both sides reasonably compromised using the statutory mechanism of 505.07. And to answer Judge Griffin's question of a moment ago, how does a referendum become nullified under Ohio law? The General Assembly of Ohio has shown us the exact requirements, all of which were met here. There needs to be notice and opportunity to be heard, both at the township level and before the court. That took place here. Judge Marbley made an explicit finding that all of the notice and hearing requirements of the statute were met. And then he went on to note that the settlement is fair and reasonable. So even if you reach the quote unquote merits of the consent decree, they clearly satisfy the requirements of the statute, and the settlement where both sides gave up, the Benelkazers in terms of their ability to recover damages, attorney's fees, achieve greater density under the existing zoning, they gave that up. The township gave up the right to vindicate its rights in order to escape potential liability. It is a fair and reasonable settlement. There is no evidence to the contrary. And regardless, I think there's very clearly not just non-frivolous allegations of an equal protection violation, but in fact, as Judge Marbley correctly found, we've satisfied all of the elements to state a claim in that regard. While appellant's counsel points to certain evidence outside of the four corners of the complaint and points to Powell Crossing, that case before Judge Graham, the summary judgment standard is not in effect here. And Powell Crossing, in which I was involved, was a full-blown evidentiary hearing based on a preliminary injunction. The court had the benefit of a full record, as opposed to looking at the four corners of the complaint. Do each of the allegations of equal protection violation exist there? They do, and they certainly are not frivolous. So regardless, I agree with you, Judge Sutton, that parties can compromise their litigation at any time. We were put in a unique posture with—
One thing that I think there's some non-frivolous allegations in the complaint separate and apart from this, but one non-frivolous allegation would be the Mr. Benghazi comment. At the same time, I must say it bothers me to do that anonymously without a date. It seems to me in this day, our time in American history, we ought to be pretty careful about that kind of allegation. And it seems to me if it's going to make it into a complaint, there ought to be at a minimum, a date when it happened. And arguably it shouldn't be anonymous because it really puts the other side in a tough spot. And so I'm probably a little uncomfortable with saying that gets you past the frivolousness, because how would you know?
Well, I understand your concern, and it wasn't intended to be anonymous. It was said at a public hearing before the township trustees and their consideration of the rezoning. I also remember the comments to which you were alluding, Your Honor, where that same gentleman reaffirmed his comments, said, I don't care how he pronounces his name, it's Mr. Benghazi to me, and did call my client a terrorist. These are incredibly shocking.
No, the second one is after the complaint.
Yes, I agree. I just wanted to let you know you were remembering the record correctly. Yeah. But what we also had were allegations related to the Benghazis being outsiders, that they couldn't be trusted. And none of the public commentary went to the merits of the rezoning itself. Instead, it demonstrated animus and ill will. While Ms. Guzzo speculated in her brief that perhaps voters were thinking of the comprehensive plan and rejecting this, there's no evidence of that. And again, we're at the 12B6 stage. Did we, taking all allegations as true, tick off the three elements for a class of one claim? And I submit that we very clearly did. And so I think, Your Honors, when you look at the consent decree, can't be appealed just based on the law of this circuit.
So Mr. Miller, it sounds like you know this area pretty well. You know, the Ohio statutes contemplate exactly this, but what's your answer to, you know, voters, whether it's Genoa Township or elsewhere, that this really, you could argue, undermines the referendum option? In other words, the referendum seems to be a check on, say, trustees approving a development that isn't what the majority of voters in the township or the county want. And then you do the referendum, you get it thrown out, and then if all you have to do is a non-frivolous complaint, I mean, you know, a lot of non-lawyers could write a non-frivolous complaint and implicate the subject matter jurisdiction of the federal court, and then you have the consent decree. So is the answer what? What do you do about that?
The answer to that question is very clear. It may be unsatisfying to appellants this morning, but it is very clear. Townships in Ohio are creatures of statute. The residents of townships and townships themselves only have the rights and powers given to them by the Ohio legislature. So the Ohio legislature gave township residents the right to referendum under Ohio Revised Code 519.12. But then that same General Assembly, the same Ohio legislature, limited that right by passing 505.07, which very clearly gave the township the right, the administration of the township, to settle litigation, approving a rezoning, and that cannot be subject to referendum. So they gave the right, but they also put certain limits upon it. And so the answer to your question, Judge Sutton, is what are they to do? They should seek the repeal of 505.07. And I don't say that flippantly, and as I acknowledge, that's an unsatisfying answer to appellants, but at the same time, federal courts can't be used as an end run around a statutory framework that's very clear and here has been satisfied. So while it may seem as though that right to referendum—
Since you know so much about this area, I take it when they refer to consent decrees and court approved settlements, there's nothing in that that is referring to federal or state court. Is it covering both types of courts?
Yes, it's permissible in both federal and state courts and has been employed in both. Not simply in federal court, not simply in state court. The statute refers only to courts. But you're correct, there still has to be subject matter jurisdiction, which existed here. To close with that point, while maybe portions of the motion had been styled as 12B1, and maybe there was a suggestion in the briefing that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction, it's actually a circular argument. You don't get there unless there's no claim stated and you're thrown out of court. The fact of the matter is, when federal claims were filed, the jurisdiction of this court, the district court, was properly invoked and existed for purposes of the consent decree.
All right, Mr. Miller, you filed a cross appeal regarding the order allowing intervention and also a cross appeal as to the partial grant of the motion to dismiss. I assume those are conditional cross appeals. And if we rule in your favor regarding the consent decree issue, that those issues are moot?
That is correct, Your Honor. You need not reach those issues.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Riepenhoff, sounds like you've got 3 minutes.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. David Riepenhoff for the township. And Your Honors, just to be clear at the outset, as we were in our brief, and Judge Sutton, I will address your very first question in this argument thereafter, but the township is not challenging on appeal and did not challenge before the district court the intervener's motion to dismiss. Our purpose for the our appearance in this appeal concerned the scope of the appellant's challenge as to the consent decree. And Judge Sutton, as to your very first question in this appeal, as to the oddity of the 12B6 being adjudicated and whether or not that's a predicate to the consent decree, the only answer besides our letter brief that I can provide is that that's the way the district court treated it. It determined upon allowing the intervention to adjudicate the 12B6 motion prior to determining whether the consent.
Yeah, no, that's occurred to me. And, you know, one thought, and, you know, it's quite possible what the district court had in mind was the district court was going to be much more comfortable approving a consent decree with respect to a dispute that could clear the plausibility hurdle of 12B6. So maybe that's part of what was the thinking. But what's strange about it is that means you now have to handle the appeal on the 12B6 in the context of a case everyone's trying to settle. And of course, the point of settlement is to slow down litigation, not increase it. So that's the thing I'm struggling with a little bit.
Yeah, right, Your Honor. And, you know, other than saying that that's how the district court chose to approach the intervention and then the consent decree, we really have no procedural answer for why the district court chose to go that way. I will say, in my limited time here, that as to the scope of the intervention, I've heard what's been argued today, and I'll note that in the reply brief of the interveners on page document 34, page 16, the interveners do say that they concede that their purpose for intervening was simply to file the motion to dismiss. So we really can't reconcile that with the arguments during their first brief on page 27 about chapters 2505 and 2506, and whether the consent decree might somehow nullify their appeal under those chapters or something.
Well, they're kind of linked, because if you win on 12B6, you don't get the odds are high there wasn't going to be a consent decree. So that suggests this was their vehicle for challenging the consent decree, my thinking on it, but not sure.
And your honors, as to the fairness and the reasonableness of the consent decree, and as to Judge Sutton, one of your last questions to Mr. Miller, the consent decree statute itself allows for the district court or a state court, if that's the posture it's in, to consider whether the consent decree is fair and reasonable. And given the record here, including that, what was discussed at the consent decree hearing with the technical review of the application, the court would have considered that this is, a lower density and all the other terms that are connected with the settlement. That's my time, Your Honors. Given barring any other questions, then I'll defer. Thank you for hearing us.
Thank you, Mr. Riepenhoff. Ms. Guzzo, you've got your rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors. With respect to the Sixth Circuit 1981 Vanguard of Cleveland versus the city of Cleveland. The court held, it does not, however, it held that a party does not lack standing to appeal the entry of a consent decree simply because it's not bound by the consent decree. Moreover, the United States Supreme Court in 1980 in Deposit Guarantee National Bank versus Roper, to have standing, the party must just have been aggrieved by the judicial action from which to appeal, which we have been because of the rights of the results of the referendum as neighboring property owners. They're being limited by this consent decree. Number two or three, Scotts versus Memphis, the Sixth Circuit in 1982. The ability to appeal the consent decree was only limited to those people who's part of the consent decree. It doesn't prevent someone who's not part of the consent decree, who's aggrieved by the consent decree, especially here, their fundamental rights of the results.
I don't have much doubt that you're able to say you were injured when 75% of the voters didn't want this development. So I don't think that's very difficult.
Okay. And then with respect to, the plaintiffs have just stated to you that the public records shows that there's animus and ill will. That's not the case. They made that assertion, the allegation. However, because they implicated the meeting, we then the interveners and their motion to dismiss provided for the court, for the district court for judicial notice, the public records. And nowhere does it say Benghazi, nor does it say anything that's animus to the applicant. Okay. And then,
for what it's worth, Ms. Guzzo, if the only goal is a non-frivolous complaint, I should think they could probably meet that standard simply by showing that, other developments that were similar were approved, and they have that argument. Remember, it just has to be non-frivolous.
They do not have that argument. What they did is they actually made that allegations, but then they attached to the complaint the actual, what was actually rezoned to date. And only one property, the Venmar property.
Why isn't one enough to be non-frivolous?
Yeah, but because what I tell you is the Venmar properties, which was approved in 2002 and 2013, had a density of 1.14. That was the argument. Theirs was 1.89. So that wasn't a material, there was not a material similarity that this circuit has said, when you're going to have a class of one economic discrimination, you got to be in all material respects.
Yeah, Ms. Guzzo, I think you'd probably have me on the merits if it were summary judgment, but it's a non-frivolous complaint where you figure out factually later whether it clears plausibility or after that material dispute of fact. That's the trick in this case.
I think it's exactly the same as Kenny versus Blackwell, which is actually in Genoa Township. The same attorney that's representing this plaintiff represented them. The Sixth Circuit upheld the district court and said, you have no subject matter, or you they dismissed the complaint. The defendants thought, are they?
I'm pretty confident, if I'm remembering that case correctly, wasn't that on summary judgment?
But what they did is they filed for a motion on the pleadings.
Was not summary judgment.
They filed a motion on the pleadings, which is a 12-6, which the court treats as a 12-B-6, or alternatively, a motion for summary judgment. The court went ahead and ruled on the summary judgment, but their actual motion was either or. And they said there wasn't a claim here, and the court agreed. They didn't have, their substantive rights weren't denied. They didn't have a right to the rezoning to a planned residential district. And their unequal protection wasn't, they weren't treated unequally because every property is subject to a referendum when they're asking for a rezoning. And they didn't get their declaratory judgment. It was just.
Thank you so much, Ms. Guzzo, Mr. Miller, Mr. Riebenhoff. Really appreciate your briefs. Thank you for the supplemental brief and, of course, for answering our questions, which we're always grateful for. Thanks so much. The case will be submitted. The clerk may adjourn.
This honorable court is now adjourned.